just let me down. What have I done? It's a crime. And I don't know what to do when I am in front of you. Oh Lord, let
okay,
me
so
down.
I am here with Jamie Gorton, who is most recently the author of Lord of Misrule. Jamie, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. It's great to be in New York.
Yes, and it's, well, I met you on the dance floor at the National Book Awards ceremony. I didn't say hello, and now I can, so.
We were dancing.
We were dancing, yes, it was great. I wanted to, first of all, start off with the Gargoyle interview from 1983, which has made the rounds. There are a number of things that are interesting about that. It was called A Vintage Interview by the Millions, which I thought was interesting. But I was curious because the best young fiction writers in that piece, the names cited were Tom Ahern, Michael Brondoli, Ken Timmerman, Meg Wolitzer, and you. And as Moby Lives pointed out, the only name really that we recognized from that list was Meg Wolitzer. You said at the time that Michael Brondoli is the most likely to write a great American novel, as that artifact is traditionally understood. And yet Brondoli had one more volume in him, which was Showdown, the short story collection. So many writers give up. Many writers sell out. Many writers corrupt their voices. And the whole process is very much similar to how Hollywood actors destroy themselves before 30 or 35, so there's no trace of their voice yet. I must ask, based off of that interview, in light of the idealism you expressed in that interview, how in the hell have you managed to stick it out and maintain this unique voice despite all of the assaults on small presses, on mid-listers and the like?
By the way, when I look at that list, it's one of the things in that interview that is most embarrassing to me. And anybody who thinks that I could ever give them a tip on horse racing that would be of any use should look at that list and compute. I've always felt that I could publish anything that I wrote, not necessarily at the snazziest press out there,
but I've
always had people waiting. I'm not terribly prolific.
Yeah.
Tom Ahern, who was on that list, I think is probably still writing, but he's become an advertising writer and someone who helps people with causes, organize information so that they can be better fundraisers and so on. He stays very busy. He's probably a more prolific writer than I am, even without publishing. And in fact, he wrote a novel, I forget the title right now, I'm sorry to say, about the troubles in Ireland that came out from some kind of a small press lately. So he hasn't stopped. He's just out of sight. Michael Brondoli, I got interested in finding, and I think he's working for Duke University, Duke University Press maybe. So people kind of stay near the business, and it's not impossible that they're writing, and who knows, maybe they'll have a big book. I have been fortunate because there was always a press waiting in the wings. And one press that was always waiting in the wings from the very beginning was McPherson & Company. McPherson & Company published my first strange but cherished by a few people, the 25 who actually read it, I think, novel, Champ of the City Solo. He also, when I didn't find a paperback publisher right away for my second novel, She Drove Without Stopping, McPherson & Company stepped in. With The Lord of Misrule, of which I had finished a really pretty advanced draft already 10 years ago, I didn't think I was writing this for the small presses. I thought this was a book with some commercial potential, and I eagerly gave it to my then agent, who showed it to a few places and came back and said, you know, Jamie, I think you have to face it. You're still a small press author. I was very depressed and very mad. My agent and I, she's a very nice woman, but maybe not good for that kind of book. We parted company at that point and worked on the manuscript again for a few years sporadically, took out of it some of the medicine ed material about this 72-year-old illiterate groom who knows how to work roots, knows how to do folk magic, and is looking for a home, trying to make his big score for that purpose. I reworked some of that Medicine Ed material into a separate story, which came out in Witness, and I loved the way that that chapter came together and decided I had to redo the novel that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't finish it before I was overtaken by the deaths of my two parents and other things that happened in the last decade.
Yeah.
But anyway...
Did it require an ultimatum from McPherson? Hey, Jamie, you better finish this book? Is this the only way to finish a book?
At some point, I must have rashly promised him that he could have it by the summer of 2010.
Uh-huh.
I had even kind of forgotten about that because I had many times vaguely told him, well, if no one else will do it, you can have it. But I had meant to get out there and sell it. And I do think I could probably have found someone if I had really asserted myself and gotten a new agent and so on. I'm a procrastinator and easily distracted, and I forgot about it. And suddenly McPherson said, well, it's going to be this summer, you know. It has to be this summer because I think this book could be a contender for the National Book Awards.
Yeah.
After I stopped laughing, I said, well, all right. You know, I figured this book has been sitting there, an immovable, implacable obstruction on my writing table for the last 10 years. I got to get rid of it. At the least, I got to get rid of it. I have to get it out of my way. I said, all right, I'll start revising it.
Yeah.
This was maybe back about in May.
Yeah.
But I didn't start revising it. And I found out later that he and my husband, who's also a writer, German writer, Peter Blickle, were having conferences. What are we going to do to get this woman back to work? She has to finish this manuscript. Somehow McPherson got the brilliant idea of sending me galleys with this corrupt early... It was even the earliest manuscript. I must have sent him the file back before I even took the Medicine Ed material out. And so he sent me galleys. I mean, it's easier nowadays to generate galleys than it used to be. He sent me galleys and said, well, this is the book. It's coming out on July. We're sending this to press in such and such a date. And I was absolutely horrified. The biggest problem in getting back to work on it had been that for 5 years, I couldn't bring myself to read it. I could not make... I mean, it's really hard to revise a book without reading it. And for some reason, I just had an aversion to it. I know why it was. I'll explain in a minute. But at this point, I was galvanized, horrified into reading it. And when I did, I thought, oh, this is not bad at all, actually. I had even forgotten a few subtle points of the plot. I found that I cried twice when I read it. And I thought, well, you know, I must really have something here.
Crying for the good reasons,
cried,
I hope.
I cried, yeah. And that's right. I didn't cry because I thought it was so bad. I cried because I was moved at the plights of some of the creatures therein. But anyway.
10 years of procrastination. I mean... That's a lot of procrastination, especially since the book
here... Oh, that's nothing for me.
Really nothing. Why do you require publishers and husbands to play such tricks upon you? I mean, some writers make up the excuse of like, oh, well, I'm always thinking about the novel, or I'm submerging myself in the novel when I'm not doing anything related to the novel.
How about I was occasionally thinking about the novel?
Yes.
Occasionally I thought about it.
Essentially, you've got to my dog ate my homework here, so... What's the real excuse?
What do I do?
Yeah.
Both my parents had lingering last illnesses and they required care. But I was not. I'm one of five siblings. There were plenty of others. But nevertheless, they were very big events in my life. And then there was another family member who was sick. That took time. But what did I do to make myself feel better? Did I go into my study and write?
Yeah.
No, I took Italian lessons. I got passionately involved in opera.
Yeah.
In fact, I have to write some kind of a book about opera because I've spent so much of my time following opera in the last 10 years. It's the way horse racing was for me at a certain stage. So it's going to be absolutely necessary to make use of it at some point.
Who was the novelist who said that a novel is everything that an author has been thinking about for the last 5 years.
Who was that?
I heard it was
10 years.
Or 10 years. There's variations of this quote. It seems to me that for you, it's actually the 5 years from 40 years ago. Is that safe to say? Do you require a long introspection time before finally getting the project nipped in the bud? Or
The truth is, this novel was substantially written between 1997 and about 2002.
Yes.
I know exactly the date because I was at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown as a returning fellow on the beginning of a sabbatical in fall 1997, and it just so happened that John Hawkes, who had been my teacher at Brown, was there on a senior fellowship for the month. And I always associated my passionate interest in horse racing and my urge to write about it with him, because he had written about racetracks in Sweet William and The Lime Twig. That's probably the most famous of his novels that concerns horse racing in any way. He was kind of a fantasist about horse racing, although eventually he bought a crippled old, once great stakes horse, whereas I had actually worked on the racetrack. And when I saw him in 1997, he said, I said, I'm finally going to write that racetrack novel. I'm here to start it. And he said, well, make sure you make the horses into real characters in that book, which I did,
yes.
I thought. But it didn't take an extraordinarily long time to do to write the an advanced draft. I don't write early drafts. I don't write. I don't tear through 400 sheets of paper, never looking back.
Yeah.
I construct every page and work on every sentence a long time. And I'm really fairly well along by the time I get to the end of the book the
yes.
first time. But I also do a lot of new writing when I go through those pages. Again,
you mentioned Italian. I should point out that the book contains some Yiddish in it. Tutai, in particular, he often lets loose Yiddish-like umbrechen within the dialogue. I'm not a Yiddish expert, obviously.
We see.
Then, of course, there's the average racehorse Trombonek, which is, of course, a lazy person. But what's interesting about this is that it varies from subjective third person to his actual words. I was curious about why you require several different angles, especially in relation to Maggie, where we slip into second person and first person, where she's often referred to by different names, you know, the frizzly-haired girl, the young fool's woman by Madison Ed and the like. Do multiple vantage points help you finish a book, help you realize the characters, or is just really part of this process of carefully assembling these sentences together?
In Lord of Misrule, more than in any other book, I was happy to see that I was creating certain inconsistencies about the characters, certain ragged places, in places in the novel, information is packed in. You're finding out intimate detail that's
yeah.
almost embarrassing. In other places, you realize, wait a minute, a character, we're hearing something about that character that really doesn't fit with what we've heard about them before. I was happy to have four point of view characters who don't tell each other everything. And
yeah.
that's really the point there. They're all schemers. They're all, except maybe Maggie, who doesn't believe in anything but is listening for other people's stories all the time. Each of them is constructing a philosophy of the world. And as if Tutai's philosophy of the world, which he has to construct off grounds of the racetrack because he's been ruled off for various unsavory activities in the
yeah.
past. He says he's kind of glad of that because he can get the big picture better about the racetrack. But he observes that his dog, Elizabeth, is also constructing her philosophy of the world. There's an awful lot of that going on. But I think that private people who scheme and who don't talk, who don't show their hands and don't tell other people everything, would probably turn out to have a philosophy that was incongruent with yours, incongruent with mine, incongruent with the next five people that they walked by. And that fascinated me for the racetrack in particular, the lying capital of the world, where these people really need each other. One thing that I loved about the racetrack, at least in my day, there were no TVs and not even very many radios. People told each other stories all the time. That was the main way of passing time. People are telling each other everything all the time, and yet they are finding ways of not telling the truth and not telling all, certainly not telling all, even about their own plans and intentions for the fourth race tonight.
It almost seems to me that much as Cynthia Ozick constantly goes back to the 50s in her work, or much as Marilyn Robinson goes back further, there seems to be this time before television, before internet, where a storytelling culture, you really have to access that particular mode, I suppose, in American history.
That's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but maybe that's really part of it.
Yeah.
One of my favorite books, Edwin Mulhouse, the Rise and Fall, is it, of an American writer, by Stephen Milhauser.
Yeah.
Is a perfect textbook, really, for an American childhood and all of its absurdities. I mean, a beautifully written, complex, bejeweled manual of American childhood, which I can have my students read today, and they fully enjoy it, and they don't even notice that there's no television in it. That's really the most important central fact for having such a lively view of American childhood. Although I must say, some of my students, the writer Kelly Wells, who won a Flannery O'Connor Prize from University of Georgia.
She's appeared on this program too. Yeah.
Oh, has she?
Yeah.
Well, she's a terrific writer. And she uses television all the time. I mean, she's from a generation that is in some ways immune to the numbing effects of TV, because it was always there. There was no television until I was 5, 6, 7 years old. So,
yeah.
So I've never gotten fully used to it.
It's almost as if television is to, I suppose, the last 30 years of literature as sex was with D.H. Lawrence. He comes in and suddenly the subtleties of language are just broken down and things are laid bare, and then all of a sudden everybody can write about sex, just as now everybody can write about television. Almost.
Maybe that's true.
Yeah.
Maybe that's true. And they can certainly write about it better than I would be able to. It's funny, first I thought you were going to say, I see that you write about one period, your 20s. And it's true that...
Well, I don't look at it at all, because some people get locked into a particular decade. It doesn't really matter what age they are. But it is interesting that that decade speaks to them most in their fiction.
Well, I think I'm through with my 20s now. I think I've used them up, finally, anyway. My next book will be about being a grown woman, I hope.
Well, it's been said often that novelists have to stay young. Might that also be one of the reasons why you're interested in this younger part of you, that you have to keep the kid alive in order to keep the voice fresh, I suppose?
In my youth, I consider that my youth lasted until I started teaching at the university, when I had to become a respectable person somewhat. In my youth, I seldom turned down an adventurous opportunity, even if it was a little bit dangerous. So there was plenty of material there.
Yeah.
I was in no hurry. I hung around with criminals. I worked in a jail. I worked on the racetrack. I drove back and forth across the country alone a couple times.
Yeah.
I worked in a mental institution, or anyway in the front office of one. And I know it's kind of a tradition with writers to list the ridiculous jobs that they had in their 20s.
Yeah.
And the back cover of their first novel. But I feel as though, in some ways, immaturity preserves you.
Yeah.
Not having a big book until you're 65 also preserves you in that sense. Preserves a certain kind of naivete or innocence.
So,
I don't have any other kind of innocence, but that
kind. Got it. So to a certain degree, the fact that you, I mean, it seems to me that you haven't striven for any, at least actively for any commercial success. And it has eluded you, although you've had the 25 readers who have now become 25,000, perhaps more.
And they were really loyal readers, those 25.
Oh, yeah?
I want to say that. Yeah.
Wow.
That's what I mean. That in that sense, I've always felt fortunate. I knew that there were people who really felt that I didn't write like anybody else and who had access to presses, maybe not the biggest presses, but I felt that my biggest problem was not that I didn't, they couldn't make anybody pay attention to my work, but that I didn't work enough.
Yeah.
That I have a very strong streak of non-prolificity for whatever reason. And I think the main reason is that I love doing other things.
Yeah.
That was only a partial list, the one that ended with opera.
Might it also be a protective measure of some sort so that you don't get caught into the sausage factory? Or?
Now that's a very interesting thought, I wonder. I think that I have to have joy and ecstasy in my life. That's why you found me on the dance floor. And why weren't any of the other writers there? That's incomprehensible.
Yeah, you know,
to
that is very interesting. And I know that, like, Nicole Krauss basically split after the ceremonies. I mean, we don't split after the ceremonies. You've been nominated, you know, anyway.
Well, we have to face the fact that after my name was announced as the winner of the National Book Award in Fiction,
it was like,
there
it's
was
not
a dark
your party.
Silence.
Yeah.
All
no,
of a sudden,
I remember that.
People were like, who?
Yeah.
What?
Especially after Patti Smith, too. It was like, you know, all of a sudden, wait, what the hell's going on here?
It's true that things went from the sublimely ridiculous to the what? To the kind of horrified and I think that, especially because nobody knew the book, after all, its publication date had been 2 days before, and there were only there were very few copies. There had been very few reviews. Things seemed fairly ominous, even to me, for a few weeks until laudatory reviews started to appear and certain voices like Janet Maslin's came out, not only in praise of the book, but saying this. It's really not like anything else.
Sure.
In some way, I love that word exotic that you used for it. That made me feel very good.
It is exotic if you live upstate, I suppose. But anyway, I wanted to ask, did any of the judges contact you after, like Chip Delaney or anybody? Or
No. I've known Andrei Codrescu since the 70s.
Got it.
And he had already... While the book was still a finalist, he spoke to the Wall Street Journal, which was amazing to me that he dared to do that. It was wonderful. Great for me. No, I hadn't spoken to any of the others, and I still haven't spoken to them, although I wrote a blog about them for Powell's Books, who asked me to blog over Christmas holidays. I wrote a blog because I thought it was high time to say, and I should really send it to each of them. Why was I such a klutz that when I finally got up to the microphone at the National Book Awards, I took the trophy in my hand and said, "Wow, this thing is really heavy." Instead of saying what was really important to say, "Thank you, judges, for making this courageous decision." Because the book had no press at that time, they were really going out on a limb for me, saying that this was the best book, and nobody else from the publishing industry had expressed an opinion about it. They could have been made to feel like fools, and they didn't let that stop them. And I feel deeply grateful to them for their independence and nerve, their sheer nerve in picking my book.
Let's jump back to A Night's Work, which is the story that was one of the genesis points of this book. I did read the story. It features Kid Stuff dying at the very beginning, Nurse Pigeon finding him dead. And then you have, of course, Tutai. We learn his last name is Samuels. I had no idea until I read that story. This suggests that you were thinking about these characters for quite a long time, but there are a number of things like Rose Dewglass. Why didn't she appear in Lord of Misrule? And for that matter, there is a character, Diamond Doug, who is referenced in Lord of Misrule, which led me to believe, I wonder if Diamond Doug had another life somewhere. Just How many characters did you have bubbling around your mind for the last 10, 15 years here?
I want to say that because I'm so unprolific, as mentioned earlier, I had every intention of wrapping the novel around that
really?
Story
yeah.
and absorbing it into the novel. That would be 30 pages I wouldn't have to write. So I fully hoped to do that, but I just couldn't quite get them congruent. What's more, if you stop and think about it, if you know both books, you'll realize that one character is alive and one is dead in each of those two works.
Yeah.
But they're different characters, so it's logically impossible on the planet Earth or in the universe as we know it.
Unless it's a Schrodinger reference, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And that, of course, is a little mathematical error that I made and didn't even strike me until the novel had been in print for 3 weeks. Oh, my God. It's not possible.
But who was asked questions about this? Who was pointing
no
this
one.
Out?
Yeah, well, exactly. Actually, one fan did. One uh-huh. fan finally did. But no critic, no one
yeah.
who is as knowing as you are about letters. So I'm hoping that this will disappear back into the swamp where it came
yeah.
from. But anyway, well, there are always minor characters. I think that I didn't know exactly who was going to be in my racetrack story when I started it, and who did I come out of that novel thinking, oh, there I've really got somebody. That's important. That is a character I could work with for another 300 pages easily. Tutai, I was very happy about. Somebody had given me the name Tutai back in 1980. Somebody at a dinner party I was at once said
yeah.
that she had run into somebody from the rackets with the name Tutai. And I never saw another Tutai in print anywhere, so I figured it was there to be used.
It reminded me of Two-Face,
but then I had
the
to,
Batman universe.
That's right,
yeah.
exactly. And I had to explain it to myself in some
yeah.
way. Kid Stuff, now I knew many of Blacksmith very like kid stuff. For some reason, the besetting vice of blacksmiths is drinking a lot, and of course that is kid stuff's problem too. And I knew many racetrackers, pretty fellows from Louisiana, of very mixed ethnic heritage of one kind or another, charmers, kind souls like kid stuff. But Kid Stuff is definitely a composite character. The interesting thing about Tutai is that I had finished A Night's Work. It was already in Best American Short Stories. I was getting ready to start the novel when all of a sudden it struck me. My God, I was writing about my great uncle Willie there. I had
yeah.
come totally forgotten about this uncle of mine who not only had obscure functions around the racetrack that some in my family wanted to call those of a petty crook, but I found out later were maybe not so petty.
Yeah.
And he was murdered in 1980. You know, I remember very clearly the headlines in the Sun papers about it. And when the identity of this body was disclosed, the title Loan Shark was very clearly right there next to his name. Now, nobody in my family had ever said, you do understand that your Uncle William is a loan shark, don't
yeah.
you? No, we never heard that. We'd heard Willie and Jake went to jail for the dirty bookstore. Only years later, I thought, you don't go to jail for a dirty bookstore. What do you mean, went to jail for the dirty bookstore? Dirty bookstore, an adult bookstore on the block in Baltimore, where there are plenty of such places. But there are lots and lots of other ways that a grown man
yeah.
can get in trouble. And you have to get in enough, to get in enough trouble to go to jail, you have to be habitual and
yeah.
probably have something of a record already. And
I think
so
he wanted to expand his repertoire because he was keeping dirty books. So,
that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah,
that's true. Well, I'm not. You know, That was my mother's family, and we were the children of a respectable upper middle class lawyer, and we weren't apprised of all the details about my mother's family, which kind of amused my father, I think, but he kept it at a considerable distance. And for that matter, so did my mom. I'm sure she wasn't proud of it, but it all became very interesting to me later, and only after I knew people from the backside of Pimlico did I hear more about that uncle. But by that time, I had really written the character to tie into the book.
Yeah.
What was amazing is how close to the person that he actually was, that character turned out to be. I think I was channeled from the other side by someone who wanted to be as crooked as he could possibly be, and at the same time be kind of a kindly old gentleman who does as much good as he can from where he sits. That is not in any way to exonerate him. That's not my intention.
You mentioned inconsistencies and incongruities earlier. And it seems to me that these very inconsistencies come after you've written the book. In this case, you're basing a lot of these characters on people who you know. This leads me to wonder how aware you can be of these inconsistencies, and also how aware you can be of the fact that these characters are people you know. I mean, clearly fiction is in some sense a work of invention, but
I want to say, you know, I admit more easily than most fiction writers will do, I've seen, that I use my own life as material. I think I've had an interesting life, and I have to account for the fact that I've only written 6 books instead of 60 at the age of 60, where some, Updike, Oates, we can think of others, have huge bibliographies by the time they're my age. But at the same time, I think that I have to insist that these are still works of imagination. I think of the turn of mind. What I think of as kind of a dark romantic. I write romances in the sense that Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote romances. That is, I mythify my life almost before it's happened. I'm in the process of recasting it as a kind of epic journey, even before the paint is dry on my raw experience, let's say. So in a way, It's already not a real life. I don't really believe in real life. I don't believe in raw material. It's already fashioned by the time I sit down to write about it. In some sense, does that make any sense to you?
And I think it also explains your non-prolific nature. I mean, if you're there and you've already kicked yourself to get there at the study, at the table, to actually go ahead and turn out sentences, it would seem to me that the natural place you're going to go to is your own life, especially since the process is very slow for you.
But not for a moment do I sit down and think, what was this specific person really like? And,
No, I wasn't meaning to suggest
they've
that.
They've already become, in a way, mythical representations of themselves by the time I want to write about it, which doesn't mean that I don't avail myself of the full palette of American realism, which is a very powerful and attractive way of approaching fiction writing, or it wouldn't be so successful. But at the same time, I don't want to compromise anything in the language. And I also, just in the same way, why do I love opera so much? I was talking to my agent, Bill Clegg, about this the other day. We were at Capriccio, which is an opera exactly about this. We were thinking how what's great about opera is it's about more than what it's about. It always, you feel this powerful, muscular, dynamic happening, some sort of deeper truth being revealed that is way beyond the mere plot. And I'm after that in my fiction too. I think that's what I always want to be happening.
Well, I wanted to bring up in the Washington Post Jane Smiley wrote that your alternating points of view allow for immediacy, but not for perspective. The wisdom these characters offer is limited by the narrowness of the world. But I should point out, I think Smiley misunderstood that these characters are making compulsive decisions. On the other hand, I can sort of see her point by saying, well, where is the wisdom? Do you permit the reader to take along that wisdom? Is that something of this, I mean, I hate to use the word subconscious strategy, but is wisdom a factor or I mean, what
Jane,
of
what Jane Smiley is a terrific writer.
Yeah.
She writes big books, bigger than mine. And I think she does, in a certain sense, believe in her overarching vision.
Yeah.
That she will work it all out. She, like George Eliot before her, will understand it all, will understand the whole panorama and will find some way of explaining to you what it means.
Yeah.
I, more like Maggie, find it fascinating that, that, first of all, I give my characters credit for trying to do that too. They're all trying to work out philosophies of the world. They are consciously philosophers one way or another.
Yeah.
And I feel as though that's as much panorama as I really want or need, especially in this book. I love the fact, I mean, that is my vision.
Yeah.
I love it that that characters, whether they have education or not, are thinkers.
Yeah.
And like me, maybe better than me, are actually making progress and piecing it all together on their own. Within that scheme, they reach out to other people, are kind, are self-protective, get desperate, betray their friends, do all the things that people really do.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to give a final answer to this. Not in that book. Not in a book about horse racing.
Yeah.
Maybe someday when I have a revelation about the nature of God and the universe, I'll be able to do it for some other book. But of all the worlds that I'm ever going to write about, this is the one where I was the least inclined to do that.
Yeah. Not for you, tidy resolution.
No.
Because life is not tidy resolution.
No, no. And because everything about the racetrack is cyclical.
Yeah.
Up one day and down the other, feast, famine, fortune is pouring in, good fortune is draining out. And that's the nature of the game. That's the lesson that you learn from it.
Well, on the subject of panorama, I actually wanted to talk with you about description. The character description, like Tommy, has wormwood green eyes, blue-black mustachios. You describe Maggie's trailer, yellow crinkly plastic like chicken skin at the aluminum stripping hanging down from the door of the sardine can toilet. This is all great, but I'm wondering how much description is enough for you. You strike me as someone who could probably fall down the linguistic rabbit hole quite easily. And so how do you manage this?
Well, I'm sure that from the point of view of the average, even the average dedicated literary reader, Champa the City Solo was a little bit more language than they ordered.
Yeah.
Even when they thought they ordered the blue plate special of language. Wait a minute, this has got 39 sauces on it. That's too many.
But sometimes you need 39 sauces.
Well, for me, I still love Champ of the City Solo. It's the kind of book I like to have around on a table, on a telephone table, or on the back of the toilet, so that I can flip through it. That's that's the best way to make use of it, not to take it too seriously as a plot. With Lord of Misrule, I was very conscious. I'm going to write a novel now I expect to be a readable novel, at least to people who have good vocabularies and read fearlessly the most interesting books of their generation. But nevertheless, it's going to have a plot, it's going to be exciting, it's going to make full use of suspense and so forth, but I'm not going to compromise at all in the language. I feel that I can render that world. And I'm satisfied. I mean, everybody's not going to go for it. There have been a few hilarious voices reviewing it on Amazon.
Yeah.
But if racetrack people, if and who knew there were so many people who follow the racetrack but also read and read at a highly literate level. If racetrack people love my book, then I've accomplished more than I hoped in my wildest dreams. And that seems to be the case. Some of the best reviews or the most enthusiastic and pleasing to me came from horse racing writers like Joe Drape and Andrew Beyer. Andrew Beyer is a god to people who follow horse racing. Teresa Gennaro. Horse racing people have really paid attention to this book. I was a little scared because, after all, I hadn't been actively on the track for over 30 years.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure I had everything right. I'm sure I don't have every little last detail right, but I got enough right, so it's exactly those passages of description that move them the most. They feel that they are smelling, hearing, sensing, not only in the setting, but actually in the types of characters who turn up.
Yeah.
People that the racetrack they're familiar with, and I think that's what excites them about the book. So I feel... I'm pretty at ease on that score. Even if, I mean, it may be overwriting from the point of view of some recent MFA graduates who are too fresh from the workshop and love to complain about everything. But if racetrack people think that I wrote a good book,
yeah,
and I mean racetrack people who write and read, then I'm very happy.
So, I mean, you say that you don't compromise, but it could be argued that by writing a novel, you are compromising because you now have to confine your work into plot in order to make it accessible to some kind of audience, even this more literate audience that seems to be there. But the happy accident here is that you have the racetrack crowd who is reading the book. Is it safe to say that, I guess, any commercial appeal you have, any desire to connect to an audience is largely sort of, hey, here it is, and it's kind of accidental, it's out there, we'll see if people want to read this, or what's the deal here?
Maybe saying that I wanted to write or thought I had written a novel with commercial appeal is the wrong way to put it.
Yeah.
I wanted to get plenty of wonderful books, plenty of writers whom I love anyway, have been trade press authors from the start, and their books appear in airport bookstores. Why not mine? That was one of my most vulgar but deepest desires, to see my book in an airport bookstore. And yes, I have. I check it out in every airport.
Every writer has a rant or few.
That's true. But I want to say that on the matter of plot, or having to confine myself to a novel and the usual arc of a novel, that to me is not a cruel fate that's limiting me. I'm a reader too. I actually love books that deploy suspense. I don't think that they have to be any worse written than The Dubliners or Robert Stone's Dog Soldiers, actually one of my favorite books. One of the novels that I had in mind when I went to work on Lord of Misrule was Leonard Gardner's Fat City, about low-end boxing in Stockton, California. Probably the best novel we have, a literary novel about boxing. I thought, well, maybe I can... Write a book about low-end horse racing that will find the same kind of niche, because I don't know that there is another one.
Have you read the Richard Stark books, Parker? They're written by Donald Westlake, and I'm telling you, these are not only compulsively readable, but they say a lot about the kind of capitalistic workings of the underworld. So what someone might just dismiss as just pulp also has kind of the secondary things. Is that kind of your relationship to some of these books, or?
In all truth, not that I don't admire pulp. I think of those as pulp detective fiction. Those are find books of a certain kind on their own. Also, I love the idea, by the way, of working on a serial basis with one character.
Yes.
I think that offers an opportunity. After all, Balzac, who's a great writer, was doing the same thing with characters in a massive, in the massive spread of his human comedy. So that's something that if I were even conceivably a more prolific writer, I might try. But will I be? While opera is out there, while dogs and cats and birds and other ways that I can waste time are out there and traveling and swimming and hiking and everything I like to do, probably not.
Yeah.
But I don't look at it on these novels as in any way pulp. I actually think that that the element of a novel, which takes a hold of you because you have to know what happens, and seizes you, is entertaining in the true etymological sense of the word. It takes you out of your time and puts you in the writer's time, and you can't. It won't let go of you until you find out what happened, and then you're released back into your own life. I don't look on that as in any way trivial or small. I'm amazed that that writers have allowed that to be taken over as if by the enemy, like the word conservative. You know, conservative could be a wonderful word for something that even people of my politics are trying to do, to hold on to what's good in their lives.
So, for that matter, could liberal, if people would
say. So, right. I mean, if people really thought about what these things meant. And the idea of entertainment in fiction could actually be of the highest value. And I think that Walter Benjamin actually talks about this in his famous essay on narrative. But unfortunately, most fiction writers still talk about plot as if it was some terrible burden that we had to carry. And I just don't really buy into that.
Yeah.
I think that...
plot also helps you finish the book.
Say that again?
You could be working and tinkering on the book for years and years and years, if not for plot.
Right.
I wanted to also ask you about the animals in this book, who seem to me to be just as dimensional as the humans. There's the wonderful passage with the dog who's describing the philosophy of smell. And then, of course, you have the four horses, including the apocalyptic little Spinoza. I'm curious why there is so much attention to these animal souls. I also was curious, do you have a position on animal rights out of curiosity?
No, not at all. And I was talking with Teresa Gennaro and Joe Drape last night about what position we take on horse racing, since we're all aware that it's not a sport that rises out of our humanitarian side, shall we say, since horse racing asks animals to run until it hurts, and suffering is in some sense built into excellence for horses, as for human athletes, for that matter. And we love that about it. No, I'm not. You know, I love horse racing for all of its corruption. I was thinking yesterday how Czesław Miłosz said about America that it's a moderately corrupt country. And I think he must have enjoyed creating a turn of phrase that was, instead of damning by faint praise, praising by only mildly damning. In some sense, because everybody on their track is trying to cheat, to some extent it evens out.
Yeah.
And makes a metaphor for the real world as I see it. But then again, these are just excuses. I love the racetrack because it's beautiful and exciting, and horses are the ones who are doing the competing, and it's grand to me to watch that. Why are the horses characters? Well, I can't, you know, I really can't imagine writing about any animal you know without rendering the same kind of detail. After all, it's the same job that you have with human beings. You try to go underneath and put it all together and see what makes them different from other animals who do the same things that they do, see how their looks correspond in some way to their inner selves. It just that someone said to me recently, it's wonderful how you managed to describe the horses in Lord of Misrule without being anthropomorphic. I said, are you kidding? They were perfectly anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
The whole time I was writing them, I was thinking, oh my God, this is so shamelessly anthropomorphic. How can I understand animals any differently from the way that I understand human beings?
Well,
but I think I understand human beings in a fairly, fairly complicated way that mixes what they are physically, how they smell, how they... how their parts fit together, their obvious sexuality, their not so obvious sexuality, their irony, their sense of humor. I really do think animals. How can anybody not think that animals have senses of humor? It would be absurd.
Well, given that we have such close connections, complicated connections with the animals that we take care of, with the animals who were around us, it's interesting to me how very few novels really tap into that connection or describe that connection.
Me too, yeah. Considering how much we all like animals.
Yeah.
And how, I mean, not every human being, but a substantial number of them couldn't live without animals in their lives one way or another. You know, I think that for me the trick is not that, I made up my mind that animals are more like people than we know. It's that I think the people are more like animals than we know. That I see, I think there are times when I am physically handling an animal, and then I know we're on the same electrical wavelength. I can feel it, my inhibitions have dissolved. The animal's inhibitions have dissolved, and we are literally in some sort of electrical pull together. Why shouldn't that be so? I mean, isn't most of what we know about existence supporting that that contention in some way? So,
well, when you said that, it's funny. I mean, I hear you out here on the emotional and corporeal connection, but I was also thinking mentally there are a lot of similarities between human beings and animals.
Oh,
that would be a cynical statement to make.
No, I really think it's true, except that that in some way the horses are always more honest. They really, I mean, race horses, most of them, at least until they're sore, really want to run. They really want to win. We're sometimes telling them, not this time, or... I'm sorry, you forget it, or something of the kind. Come to think of it, it's not that a horse won't occasionally try to fool you, just like a person. Well, I'm not really trying to win this one. Oh, yes, I am, at the last minute. So, come to think of it, a horse that runs over the distance, just like an athlete who runs over the distance, gets to use more of his intelligence than... a sprinter.
Yeah.
And we respect him on that account.
So might a novelist, actually, as well.
You could say that. You could. A few people would be really mad at you. Those sprinters wouldn't like hearing that, would they?
That's true. Jamie, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It was wonderful.